Hi, I'm Leigh Don Hines, and this is How to Fall Apart. For this series, we've done something a little different. It was fully inspired by a conversation I had with the amazing Dira Nugriefa when I interviewed her for Life magazine about her book, A Ghost in the Throat. Much of that book covers Dira's life as a mother of young children, the day-to-day tasks and grind of domesticity, and how she balances her life with her family with finding time for her writing. When we talked, Dira said two things that I couldn't stop thinking about for weeks afterwards. We talked about how Dira was often asked if it had felt exposing to write the book. And she said how she felt the word exposing, quite often what people really meant was, aren't you ashamed of yourself? She said, so you've told the truth of your life as best you can with this book. It's very exposing, isn't it? And she would think, yeah, it's exposing. And it really brought to mind something some people had said to me when my book came out, which was, it's very honest, isn't it? And clearly that wasn't meant in a good way. And in my head, I would think the same as Dira. Yeah, so? This isn't to suggest that everyone needs to tell their story with, you know, certain levels of honesty, but to say that if you are comfortable with that, then why not? As Dira said, own the openness and create work that reveals the messiness of what it is to lead a human life. She also talked about how, as a total bookworm who reads all the time, she had noticed that there were some versions of herself that she felt she was never encountering on the page. In Dira's case, one of the things she wrote about was losing desire after having a baby for a time when you were breastfeeding, and how that made it feel even more urgent to be open about these things in her own book. These two ideas, the experience of writing about your own life and the desire to record parts of your experience that you don't necessarily see elsewhere, are what I'm going to be talking to my guests about for this series, putting herself on the page, as well as talking about their stories themselves, of course. I'm hugely grateful to all our brilliant guests, and especially with this first episode, to the truly special Dira. If you haven't read her book, do now. It's incredible. When you started out writing the book, did you have an idea in your head of the form it was going to take and the story you were going to tell, or how much of it happened as you went along?
I think for me, the process of writing a book, and it's in a process that's still very new to me, but for me, it's a process of unfolding. There's a sense of the unknown about a book, and that it begins to reveal itself the more time you spend with it. So for me, I think the act of writing, of literally sitting down with my laptop open or with my notebook in my hand, is like an act of listening, and the book comes gradually in those moments. When I was writing A Ghost in the Throat, I didn't really know what I was doing, and I don't mean that in the way of like trying to do myself down. I mean, like, I literally didn't know what kind of a book I was writing, really. And there's a certain amount of trust in writing like that, a trust in the act of unfolding, and in the sense of necessary mystery that's involved with any creative act. And that's not to be highfalutin about it, because I think I often observe children when they're drawing a picture or writing a story, and it mystifies and I find it so charming to watch a child making something, because there's none of the questioning self-doubt and there's no, that we have as adults, and there's no sense of what we do all the time, which is trying to look at the bigger picture. So in the act of trying to write A Ghost in the Throat, I tried to yield to that a bit, I think, and to just let myself be in the flow of the writing process, to let the writing come through me, and to trust that it would become itself, whatever itself would be. I didn't try to second guess what that would be. And it did reveal itself, that book, in a strange way. And I'm very glad now, looking back, that I trusted that process, that I didn't try to cleave more towards a sense of coherence in a traditional way, that I didn't try to write a book like many, many other books I've written, that I let this book be what it wanted to be itself. Mm-hmm. So yeah, for me, with The Ghost in the Throat, it was allowing this unfolding to happen.
Okay.
And I'm just beginning to write another book of prose now, and it's so different from A Ghost in the Throat, Leah. And I can feel that urge in myself, the want to control, the want to know what it's going to be. It's like you're fighting against yourself almost, you know. You want to know, what am I doing? What is this supposed to be like? But the more I can let myself trust in that mystery again, the more it happens almost of its own accord. I feel like our books know what they want to be, and the less we fight them, the more that process can unfold.
In the opening pages, there's a line, "This is a female text, and it is a tiny miracle that it even exists." Can you tell me what you were getting at then with that line?
Yeah, I think I was genuinely astounded that this book was becoming a book, and that the process really was unfolding, that it was becoming itself, and becoming itself despite the fact that it was growing from my life, which is restricted in many ways. I can't do what I thought proper, in inverted commas, proper writers do, which is like devote themselves entirely, body and soul, day upon day, year upon year, to the creation of a work of literature. Long artistic residencies in beautiful houses in the countryside. Instead, I was someone who was grabbing every minute that they could, hurrying off to the roof of a multi-story car park near my child's school and just writing and writing and writing. This wasn't the image that I had in my head of how someone writes a book. And it really did astound me that it was becoming itself, despite the fact that it was happening under circumstances that were different from what I would have presumed.
Yeah.
Now, you and I both know that books are written under many, many different conditions. People write books while they're parenting. People write books while they're holding out full-time jobs and many other things, caring for so many people around themselves. And this isn't unusual in any way. And it's nothing that I'm trying to, you know, say glory, glory me over or anything. But that line is in the book because it genuinely did surprise me. And I felt a sense of astonishment.
When you were writing, how did you're writing about yourself. Did you struggle to not self-edit, or how did you find that? Like the voice in your head watching what you were writing, or were you able to quieten that?
That's such an interesting question, Leah. It really is. It really is. Because I think that it's not just about writing. I think it's about living as well. I think that what you're describing there will be familiar to a lot of people in terms of how they live their lives. And if you substitute living for writing there, well, how do any of us go through our days when we have so many secret voices in our heads constantly questioning, what do other people think of me? What would that person think of what I just said there? And questioning ourselves as well, and our own decisions and our deeper urges and the grand scheme of things, that we're constantly comparing our days to this idea of how our lives should be, or how we want them to be, or how they once were. So I think that it's very close to how we live, the ways in which we write. And I, like a lot of people I'd imagine, do think about what other people make of me a lot. And so that was with me on the page, but it was in uneasy coexistence with the part of me who thinks, yeah, so who cares? Who cares? So there are so many different versions of ourselves that we bring to writing about the self. We're never writing about a singular the self. I think we're writing about many selves, and we're also writing against many selves, because, you know, the bitch in my head is just like, who is going to want to read this stuff? And you need to make yourself sound a lot more sane and a lot less unhinged. Tone down the obsession. Take out all the stuff about your intimate life. You're going to embarrass your parents. You know, everyone I think that's writing about the self brings those voices with them to the page. And the books that we end up writing are a reflection, I think, of the ways in which we have gone into battle with or against those different voices and those different selves. Yeah. And for me, with A Ghost in the Throat, whenever I'm rereading it, I've never reread it from start to finish. Mm. It's very strange for me to revisit it. But whenever I'm reading a section of it for an event or whatever, I have the sense that there are these many strata of selves that are in it. Mm. This, the self of early motherhood that I'm communicating within the book. Then there's the self who sat down and tried to write about that self. Then there's the version of myself who's coming to it a couple of years later after the book's been published. Mm. And I think each of those selves, to a certain extent, cringes at the one that went before. It's a strange thing to revisit a book in which you've reflected upon yourself, because every time you revisit it, you are again someone else. Yeah. It is bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't look back. I couldn't. Because it's so in the moment, like yeah. you say. One of the big themes, if I can say, seems to be the erasure of women's lives. And between Eileen Dove's life and your life, it's like you're trying to find record of her life. And you talk about kind of, you know, when you look at certain documents, you're deleting the men's text and you're pulling out the voice of the women. You talk about another ordinary obliteration of a woman's life. You find this little shard of crockery, and it's like a little shard of evidence. So it's like, on the one hand, you're trying to conjure back up her life. And then you're also quietly, I felt, kind of insisting on your domestic life, which we talked about before, is often not given that much room on a page. So there's the lists and the details and that kind of thing of like, this is my life. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about what you were thinking about that, about how women's lives, you know, are sometimes erased or sometimes in the present, not seen, not given that space.
I think it's a very human thing to want to tell the interesting story. The story that entertains, the story that fascinates us. And as such, we're selective in the stories that we choose to tell and retell. And I think it says so much that oftentimes historically, I presume that there wasn't an active attempt at erasing the lives and the histories of women. But the more interesting, in inverted commas, the more interesting story was told and retold and took hold of our imaginations collectively, I think, and became our written history of who we are as a people. And these acts of erasure that mean that there are these gaping absences in those tellings, I think, are sometimes as a result of carelessness and sometimes just as a result of ordinary human boredom. Some stories just seem boring to people and they aren't bothered. No one writes them down. And then subsequently, when we go in search of those stories, they're intensely difficult to resurrect. And it can be very frustrating. But I think sometimes when we consider and speak about these issues, the impression is given that there was an active silencing of women or of other voices who were intentionally marginalized. I'm not sure always that that was the case. In my experience in researching this area, it's maybe worse in a way that it's so casual. It's so casually just like, huh, who cares? Like, you know, so just a woman's thing. And as I was researching Towards a Ghost in the Throat, I could really feel my own rage building up at that, particularly when you go to primary sources like letters. And there are no letters between the women because at some stage, someone threw them all in the bin or someone burnt them. And I don't necessarily think that that was done as a really cruel effort to silence those voices. I think that people just didn't see the point in keeping them. And that's saddening and enraging, and it results in that kind of erasure. And you, I suppose, ask yourself or begin to ask yourself, well, who's complicit in this erasure? And in which ways do we erase traces of our own lives as they're being lived at the moment because of the same motivations in terms of, like, when we're writing the stories of ourselves, when we're writing books that draw on our own lives, what are the elements of our lives that we choose to leave out because of those thoughts? This is just boring stuff. This is just a to-do list. Why the hell would I put this in a book? But when we choose to include those moments, and when we choose to fight against those urges towards self-erasure, or elements of the self, and erasing them, it transforms our books into a very different kind of a document, and it welcomes the reader into a life in a very different kind of a way. So I guess because in A Ghost in the Throat, I was thinking so much about how women had been erased in the past, it encouraged me to look at the ways in which I was erasing myself. And a lot of the book became a consideration at several different levels of self-erasure and erasure historically.
You say at one point in talking about, you're talking about the scene where in Art Aquino she sees art for the first time, and she says, the poet portrays herself as the active party, which you get the sense in your writing it, like, this was rare for women of that time. And then you say at one point how literature composed by women was stored not in books but in female bodies, living repositories of poetry and song. And that because these were considered by men fallible and memory was fallible, that the Queen Who came to be considered not a work of single authorship, it was a collage. And you say this feels like a male assertion pressed on a female upon a female text. So I wondered, was that something that attracted you within the context of that second point? Were you attracted to Eileen because she put herself front and center as the active party?
I love the way Queen Arthie Lyra starts within a female body, because I feel like it starts within a female body because it starts within the female gaze. It's a female voice articulating her female gaze while she's standing in Macroom and just sees this man swagger across the street and immediately fancies him. I absolutely love that that's how the Queen begins. And before I knew that much about the poem, I had the sense of it kind of as a really dignified, slightly dreary artifact of our literature. It just wasn't that gone on it, you know. But then when I came to it and really attended to it, I was just so struck by the sense of, wow, this is a woman speaking defiantly, urgently, articulating her wants and desires. And that's how she opens the poem. It's her just staring at this man and fancying him and soon to elope with him against her family's wishes. It just astounded me. And the caliber of her voice also, really, I found it so arresting, you know, and I was so drawn to speaking the poem out loud again and again to myself and feeling that sense of her living voice surging up from my body and her voice filling the air and the sense of myself almost being like a conduit for that. And the second part of your question in terms of, yeah, it's a line of argument that is often made, that, you know, it can't be depended upon that this is the work of a single female voice. The fact that before it was transcribed and published, the fact that it was passed from woman to woman to woman over many years, this is how the argument goes, that certain elements of it would have changed and people would have embellished it in different ways. Mm-hmm. And that before it was even composed, the art of keening, the art of lament and the quina, draws on many different motifs and half phrases and phrases and certain rhymes that every woman who had heard a quina and then spoke her own quina would have been drawing on almost this library that they had inherited of all these different types of phrases. So, I mean, I can see the logic behind the argument made by certain academics that it is, that this quina, Queen Arthi Lyra, is a weaving of many different voices, the voices that came before Eileen Dove and the voices that came after her and kept this quina alive. But for me and for my purposes, that is a really enriching element of it. The fact that even if that argument is correct and there's a word here and there that was changed or half remembered and then added to by someone else, that makes it even more precious as far as I'm concerned. That's like, you know, if a little part of a glorious, extraordinary hand-woven cloak, if there's a little element of it that started to unravel at some point and someone else came along with an embroidery needle and decided to weave in a different type of thread, well, that makes it all the more beautiful as far as I'm concerned. And it doesn't do anything to undermine the fact that this is Eileen Dove Ní Chonaill's voice. It's her voice, and it is extraordinary that it has survived across the centuries. A woman's voice, a poem composed by a woman in the 18th century, part of our oral literature, and that it survived as a living artifact of her voice and her life and her wants and dreams and desires, her nightmare, her trauma, her grief, that would make its way to us will never fail to astonish me. I love it. I love it so much.
You do it such justice. It's really lovely to hear you talk about it. Can I ask, when the last time we talked, you were talking about, and we were talking in the context of writing about desire and intimacy after having a baby. And you said that, like I said earlier, you described yourself as a bookworm, so you read a lot, but there were parts of you that you didn't see on the page, and that was in part an inspiration for writing some of the books. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think for me, early motherhood, I found very lonesome in its own way. I was always busy. I was always, you know, hurrying from one task to the next. I was never alone. And then at the same time, I felt so alone.
Yeah.
And that's a really weird dichotomy that I don't think I'd felt at any previous point in my life. You know, the extreme lonesomeness of never being on your own. It's such a contradiction. Mm-hmm. But I know now at this point of my life that in a weird way, in feeling that way, you're never alone, because I think every young mother feels that way. I think every mother ever has had moments of feeling like that, of feeling frazzled and lonesome and of finding things difficult. And yet, whenever I was reading, and I do read a lot, you know, and, you know, I consume other forms of culture as well. You know, I watch a lot of telly and I watch a lot of films and I listen to the radio a lot, and I get great enjoyment from those elements of culture. And yet I never felt the sense of recognition at that moment of my life. Whenever I encountered depictions of women in a similar situation to me, it never rang true to my experience. It never felt like it felt to me. And so when I sat and wanted to begin writing A Ghost in the Throat, it was really important to me to stay true to that, because I felt the reader with me so often as I was writing.
Did you?
Yeah, I really did. I felt the reader really close to me, and I felt that sense of, like, I'm a person who can't have striking up conversation with strangers, you know. Like, even this morning I was out walking the dog in the woods. Every single person I passed, you know, we'd stop and have a bit of a chat, which is very Irish, I think, you know. But I often end up talking to strangers for a long time. And so it just felt like yet another stranger that was sitting with me as I was writing the book. And I think that enabled me to have a sense of speaking openly. I was going to say confiding there, but I'm not sure that it was necessarily confiding, but speaking openly to the reader was definitely a sensation I often had as I was composing this book. And part of that was to speak openly about how it felt to me to be living the life I was living through the days that are communicated in this book, what it really felt like, you know. And that meant sometimes feeling a little brave in myself in articulating things like the fluctuations in sexual desire that I felt and how I grappled with that and how I sometimes felt I was failing in some way as a woman, as a sexual being, how sometimes my desire failed me in the time after I'd had a baby and I was exhausted, and I just felt that part of myself kind of wilting a little. And the fact that the reader felt so immediate and so close to me meant that I had very little fear about articulating that on the page. And it has been really interesting since the book was published, Leah, to see the ways in which readers have responded to that sense of feeling them there. Because when they come to me and they're talking about reading the book, it's very clear to me that they were there, they are there. Because then when they pick up the book, they really are present in it, you know. So it was almost like as I was trying to write the book, I could feel them there. And then when they pick up the book, they're sitting into that spot, you know. And that's why they respond, I think, so strongly to it, because they were there with me, you know, and they are there with me.
And do you think, in that sense, has part of their response kind of confirmed in you that there is a certain universality to some of the stuff you're writing, because it, in the way that people have responded, they have seen themselves?
Yes, and that goes across gender and across age.
Really?
Is my experience of it. Yeah, oftentimes people assume, like, people at some stage who have mothered a child, mm-hmm. people who have given birth, mm-hmm. that they will respond more strongly to it. But I would say that most of the people who write to me are men.
Really?
Yeah, and I think that there's a sense of responding to the book just at a human level involved for any of the readers who've written to me. And, like, you have to bear in mind as well that someone who will be sufficiently moved by a book to then write to the author, you know, like, it's a quite a small sample that we're dealing with here. I'm sure that, like, I mean, it's possible that there are many people who it didn't speak to them at this level of feeling compelled to write back, you know. But across gender, I think it has resonated with people in terms of just an ordinary, everyday human vulnerability. And I think that attempting to articulate that is something that resonates with a lot of people, because we all feel vulnerable. We all question ourselves. we all sometimes, I think, embark on adventures of curiosity, and they take shape in many, many, many different ways. But we do sometimes follow our instincts in a way that leads us to strange places and to weird things that we don't fully understand. In the way that I followed Eileen Dove and attempted to find out more about her life, I think that the urge to do something like that is familiar to a lot of people in many different ways. You know, whether it's like changing job, or whether it's researching a family history, or whether it's trying something that you thought you wanted to do when you were a kid, never quite got around to, and then trying it as an adult, that the idea of identifying something, a curiosity, a passion within yourself, and then just trying it to see what's going to happen, is something that people are drawn to and that people could identify with within this book, you know. And the fact that it was being, that the adventure described in this book was being experienced by someone who was mother to several small children, and who in many ways was struggling to understand what her life was for, and where she's going and why. I think it's that essential struggle is what many readers have responded to. So yeah, definitely beyond people who've experienced this particular situation, there's an ordinary, very ordinary universality to the story too.
That's so interesting. You write about, you know, how your the domestic tasks, they kind of keep you in the moment, and you don't have to look beyond the room that you're in. And you write at one point about, well, when you're talking about breastfeeding, you say, what will become of me in the absence of this labour? Without milk, who am I? And we talked before about how the quest and the adventure of going after Eileen Dove did come at a time when the really extreme baby years were kind of passing. And that was maybe a part of you kind of needing to fill space. And, you know, I was wondering, was the writing the book part of, because you kind of talk as well about how your domestic work helped you to kind of not deal with other stuff, maybe like you're talking there about who am I and what is my life. Was the actual act of writing the book helpful in that process of figuring things out that you maybe had been kind of able to park because you were so subsumed in the tasks of motherhood and running a house and all that's involved in that?
Yeah, I love the word subsumed so much. Like, you, that could almost be like a subtitle for this book, couldn't it? Subsumed. Like, it's so much of it is about that. And yeah, I think, ask me the question again, Leah. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
I got distracted by the word subsumed. I love it so
no,
much.
No, halfway through that, I thought, how is she going to answer this? I'm asking about three different things.
Like, getting distracted by a single word is the answer.
I suppose you write in the book about how like the domestic tasks enable you to ignore things that were going on in your head or other things. Did the sitting down and writing the book, you know, and I'm really loath to suggest, because, you know, sometimes people will say to somebody who's written a book about themselves, oh, it must have been cathartic. And there's a sense of like, it was like you're writing your diary. And you're like, no, this is a really skilled person who has a particular skill and it is their work. And so I'm always cautious to kind of, you know, I'm suggesting. But I think we did talk as well about the book was part of that process of sitting with you and who you are, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that anyone sitting down to write a book, or anyone just sitting down to write a story or an article or a poem, drawing on a particular moment of their lives, what you're immediately faced with at a very basic level in that task is reflection. You're reflecting on a particular time. You're not just writing, and then this happened, and then that happened, and then this happened, and then that happened. Because you are conscious all the time in the act of writing of coherence. It's as simple as that, I think. You want to take the events of the past, the episodic events and the way things occurred, and you're trying to distill them into a coherent narrative. So that necessitates reflection and like you, I suppose I'd be kind of ambivalent about the accusations of catharsis that are always leveled at us, but it's certainly reflection is involved. I think in any act of art making that draws on the life, there's reflection and stillness and distillation as well, I think, in trying to conceive of a lived moment as something that can be communicated to another through a text. Yeah, I think it comes down to reflection. Hmm. I think so.
Yeah. Can I ask you about becoming a writer? Because you were, it happened in your mid-20s, is that right?
Yeah, I always kind of feel very self-conscious about the fact that I came to writing so late, because I'm in awe of people who come to writing and understand that they want to write much earlier in life. And I'm kind of jealous as well, to tell you the truth, of people who realise this about themselves earlier and set about becoming a writer earlier. It just seems so amazing to me. And I wish I had realized that earlier as well. But look at, I suppose we are who we are, aren't we? Mm-hmm. And for me, the beginnings of becoming a writer arose from grief. Mm-hmm. I was really close to my grandfather. He was such a lovely man. He was just a gentleman in every way. He was a really gentle person and very kind. And he had a special place in his heart for all of his grandchildren, of which I'm the eldest. And we just used to have great gas together. I was mad about him. And when he was about to die, the whole family was called to be near him. So I travelled up from Cork with my eldest son, who was a baby at the time. And my partner was working, so he stayed here. So when in Dublin we got the call in the middle of the night to come into the hospital to be with him, it wasn't felt that it would be appropriate, I suppose, to have a baby there, which at the time I kind of struggled to understand, but now I can totally understand, you know, and absolutely 100% understand. But what that meant was that everyone left and I was on my own in my aunt's house with the baby, trying to get him to sleep, and just feeling very alone and thinking so much about my grandfather and feeling strangely connected to him, even though I wasn't there, but also feeling full of sorrow. And so the lights were dimmed and I was trying to get the baby to sleep. And then these lines of a poem came to me in Irish and just repeated themselves again and again in my head. And I mean, I really, at the time, like, it was so unusual. I would never, as an adult, having left school, I would never have like written stories or poems or anything like that ever, or had any inclination to. And so it seemed so bizarre to me that there was a poem in my head. It just was so strange. So when the baby fell asleep, I got up and ran around looking for a pen and paper. And I wrote down the lines, which was only like two or three lines. But as I began writing, there were more lines that came until it was like a poem, a full poem. And I was just in awe of this, like, what was happening? And then I wrote another one. And it just seemed so strange. But in the days and weeks after my grandfather died, I kept coming back to the page and trying to write something every day. Except it didn't really feel like trying. It just felt like going to the page with my pencil and opening a tap. It just felt a bit like that. I didn't really care whether what I was writing was, whether anyone else would think of it as, inverted commas, as good work or as publishable work or anything. I just felt like, I'm going to try and write. And then I would sit down with a pen and paper and writing would happen. And I found that so beautiful. And I still do. I still find it essential I know I keep saying the word ordinary, but that's one of the glories for me about committing your life to the pursuit of literature, to put it in a very grandiose way, is that it is really ordinary. It's they're only stories. They're only like, you know, they're only the little stories we tell ourselves about our lives. Or, you know, if you were out in the smoking area behind a bar after a certain time of night and you were telling someone else, wait, you hear this one. You know, there's something so lovely about it, that this is something ordinary that we do as humans all the time, every hour of the day. We're telling each other little stories. And I just loved that from that moment of worry and grief and loneliness, that this very ordinary kind of practice came, that became such a comfort in my life and even became a way to define myself. I mean, it gave me a label. It let me start considering myself as a writer. And I'll always be grateful to my grandfather for that. You know, like, it did feel quite mysterious in a lot of ways, but it did give me a gift as well, Leah, you know. It gave me a gift of that sense of just sitting down with a piece of paper and a pencil and just starting to write.
And what was that like for you then, getting to the point where you stopped teaching and said, I am a writer, this is what I do?
Yeah, it's strange to me already looking back. It's over a decade ago now. At the fact that I realized quite quickly that I wanted to keep going with this. I mean, the moment when my grandfather died, I was on maternity leave from my job as a primary school teacher, a job that I loved and really, really enjoyed. I was teaching junior infants. I absolutely loved finger painting, teaching kids to read Marla. I loved it, and I loved the kids, and I really enjoyed just getting to know their parents and everything. But like, writing took a hold of me and took a hold of my life so quickly that I realized fairly fast that I wanted to keep going with it. And I was very privileged in that my partner had a full-time job and that I could rejig the family finances sufficiently that if we cut back a lot, like never go abroad, that kind of thing, and buy everything I could secondhand and at car boot sales, that I was able to hobble together a life where we could get by on a single salary and I could follow the writing to see where it would lead me, which hasn't been, at this point, to any kind of enormous financial glory, to tell you the truth, or towards a life with a pension. But it has brought me to some other really interesting places and has allowed me to reflect on myself and on the life that I have been living in a way that has allowed me to make sense of it on the page. That act of reflection we were talking about earlier, I felt so fortunate to have had that in my life. And every time I'm speaking about writing, it feels really important to me to emphasize that really anyone who wants to can do this, you know. There's nothing that fancy about it. When I was a primary school teacher, when I was teaching first and second class, I would often, you know, say, okay, take out your copybooks. I would just say 6 or 7 different nouns, write them on the blackboard and be like, make me up a story about that. I really can't wait to hear it. There was never a single child in any of my classes that would say, I can't do it. Never. Because as people, we can make up stories, and every single one of us are living really exciting and weird and strange lives, every single one of us, and every single one of us is nosy about the other people's lives around us. So we're natural composers of life stories because we're living them, and we're natural readers of other people's life stories because we're nosy. And I really like that about us at a human level. I like that we're nosy, and I like that we all have our own stories to tell if we want to tell them.
Yeah.
You know? And anyway, that's all. I just think it's important to say, because I know oftentimes when there's if there's a podcast episode like this, that the person who will be drawn to listening to it is someone who's curious about trying to write or communicate their own story. And I think it's really important to say you can absolutely do this. You can do it. If you pick up a pen and paper and if you put a timer on your phone for 30 minutes and you say, it doesn't matter what I write, I'm just going to fill these papers with words, anything at all, for 30 minutes. You will surprise yourself, I promise you that. At the end of the 30 minutes, you will have written something interesting.
You touch on that from in the terms of like doing it, from the angle as well of the time and the kind of nature of, so when you're writing about motherhood and spotting the gap in the day and the kind of balance between needing to rest and driving yourself into the ground with the obsession and the doing justice. And I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about that, about like I'm always loath to kind of say that there's a, you know, suggest anything should be like this in motherhood or there's certain better ways of doing things. But, you know, you're very immersed in motherhood, but you're also very immersed in your work. And you told me the last time about that thing of like, you know, after the dinner's been, after everyone's been fed, skirting past the couch and not going to sit down, but like grabbing that half hour. So that kind of like that, the work you're doing is not kind of tidy 9 to 5, I'm off, I have my space. Can you tell me a little bit about that, about that melding those two things and how it works for you, like finding, like you've gorgeous pictures on your Instagram where you're like sitting at the desk, you know, and it's really dark and you're obviously grabbing, you know, it feels like maybe it's bedtime is happening in the background or something. So that thing, and you said earlier about being on the roof of the car park, how for you your work happens in those spaces and how you kind of manage that and how that works for you. It's an incredibly long question, sorry Dern. Feel free to be like, what are you asking?
No, I know what you mean. And I think it feeds into, again, what we were talking about a minute ago, that this is something that everyone can do. There doesn't necessarily need to be a beautiful writer's study with mahogany desk and book-lined walls and shelves and shelves and shelves and like a really beautiful atmosphere of the intellectual. It is possible to write books in the quiet moments of a day. It is possible. It's not easy. I'm not necessarily proud of myself and the life that I have tried to build for myself with the fact that I am constantly eyeing up my days, looking for little moments that I can run off and devote to writing. I'm not necessarily proud of the person I am in that sense, because what that means is that you're very often distracted. You're not always completely in the moment, because there's some part of you, the cold little claws of the artist, and there's some part of you is always, in fact, I shouldn't say of you, like to other people, there's some part of me, I'll own that, right? There's some part of me has very cold pair of little claws, and those claws always want time. I always want time. I always want to run off and take a little minute if I can find it and just immerse myself in whatever I happen to be writing at that moment. And I don't know if it's a good way to live, Leah, but all I know is that it's the way that I can live. It's how I have to do things myself, but I do sometimes feel ashamed of it. And I do sometimes wonder if I would be a better person, a better mother, a better sister, a better wife, if I wasn't a writer, and if I wasn't constantly having one eye on what's occurring around me and the people around me, and the other eye ticking away, constantly turning over some element of the book or the thing I'm writing on constantly. It's like both of my eyes are going in two different directions, you know, and one of them is turning inwards constantly towards my craft, and that eye that's turning inwards is very selfish. And so, like, I mean, I definitely wouldn't always be gloating about it. I mean, when a book like A Ghost in the Throat is published, that book has a cost, you know. There's a cost to someone in my situation writing a book like that. There are many, many, many hours that it takes.
Yeah.
And those hours are all nabbed from elsewhere. You know, at times where I could be trying to make things happier and easier for people around me, but I don't. I run off and I write my books. And that's, you know, that has been really important to me. Mm-hmm. And I've learned a lot from being and becoming that person. But yeah, I'm not sure that it's something I should be boasting about either, you know. I don't know. I'm still figuring it out.
I know. Because even when you say selfish, I think, but like when you describe actually the reality of your life, so much of it is doing things for the people you love and you're happy to do that. I don't mean any sense of martyrdom. So like, is it selfish to keep part of it for yourself, which is your writing?
It is and it isn't, I think.
I'm genuinely asking. I mean, I think maybe it all
hinges on boundaries. Mm-hmm. Part of it, like you're describing, keep part of it for yourself. I can see how that would be more palatable. And I guess as well, it depends on the time in which you interview someone like me. Like at the moment we're speaking in the middle of the summer holidays, very different from the conditions in which I wrote A Ghost in the Throat, where there was a clear window every weekday morning of 3 hours. While my youngest was at preschool, where I didn't feel I was stealing from anyone or anything. Where I could just have that clear time where I wasn't wanted anywhere else to write a book. Whereas now you're speaking to me in the middle of the summer holidays, where every time I run off and hide myself away to write a poem or to do some research for my next book, I do have the sense that, oh, you know, I could be doing something.
And I 100%, like even last night, I put the TV on at 6 and left it on for 3 hours, if I'm going to be really honest, because I had to read stuff for work. And I know exactly the thing. And you're sitting there thinking, this is not the best thing for her, but I have to do, you know. So I totally understand that thing that you're describing. I wanted to ask you just lastly, Darren, when we talked last, we talked about the word, about people saying to you something like, you know, did you feel it was very exposing to write a book like this? And that you said that that word came very close for you to, are you ashamed of yourself? And that in that question, it was as if somebody was saying, so you've told the truth of your life. And it's very exposing, isn't it? And you think, yeah, it is exposing. And like, what of it? So I wondered if you could tell me about that feeling of how exposing, you know, there's an undertone there of, and that's not a good thing, first of all, and how you, you know, how you felt about that.
I think when people read a book like A Ghost in the Throat, which grew very much from my life, and they ask whether I felt like it was very exposing to write a book like that, that question, and particularly that word, is really like a little key that unlocks a door about the person who's asking the question, because there's something that's been internalized at a very deep level within that question and within that word and possibly within the person, where they're looking at someone who's written a book like this and saying, oh, and saying, I'm being very inarticulate here, and saying, oh, but yeah, I think, and saying, oh, doesn't that feel very strange? And I don't think necessarily it's always about feeling judgmental, but that it is always, as far as I can see, and I could be totally wrong in this, that it is always about like, and don't you feel strange about that? And don't you feel ashamed of yourself? Like as if we're supposed to keep our private lives very, very private and not create works of art or literature from our lives. our lives as we perceive them, as we own them and live them and live in our lives. And it is exposing to write a book like that, but not in an uncomfortable way necessarily. Because like I was describing, feeling the sense of the reader being with me as I was writing A Ghost in the Throat, I never thought, this is so exposing. It felt much more, it felt much closer to an act of gentle intimacy with another human being in a way that I think stopping to talk to a stranger for a few minutes, meeting their eye, hearing what they have to say, you know, exchanging a few stories. There's something I think that's really pleasant and very intimate in a really ordinary, gentle way about that kind of an interaction. And it's something that we really missed, I think, from our days over the pandemic, you know, that sense of just meeting someone and communicating something of your life to them, and the reciprocity of that, of someone returning that kind of an interaction. And that has never felt exposing to me. And the act of writing about my life has never felt exposing to me either. It has felt enriching to communicate something of my deeper self, of my quiet self, of my worries and my fretfulness. That feels like an act of trust, I guess, to communicate that to a reader, in the same way that it does to have a conversation with someone. And that feels really precious to me. And it is, I know I keep saying over and over again, using the word ordinary, but there is joy in ordinariness. And I think our literatures, that as we compose them, should reflect that sense of, that sense of attempting to articulate some deeper truth of our lives, and trusting that the reader will be there to read it and to understand in their own way. And I think that's why I tend to resist words like exposing, because exposing does feel quite close to shame for me.
I think as well, that kind of, you know, exposing or those kind of words, they come from a place that suggest that you are out there on your own. But my experience of writing something that was, I suppose, personal, was actually that it was a complete act of connection.
Yes.
Because in the response, you get, like, the thing that was most commonly said to me was, it's like reading my own life when I wrote about going through a separation. So I think that's the thing that you understand when you're in it, when you've done it, that you're in no way out on your own, that actually by putting it out there as in just, this is how it is, and I'm just recording something of a life and a part of a life, that actually you get back this response that is, you've connected to other people rather than being in any way, because I suppose exposed also suggests an isolation or an out there on one's own. And actually I found it was the complete opposite to that.
Yeah. I think that willfully or willingly, I should say, stepping into kind of a zone of vulnerability with a reader invites vulnerability in return. And maybe rather than exposing, maybe that's closer to what we're trying to communicate. You know, do you not feel it's very exposing, could perhaps be imagined as, do you not feel very vulnerable in it? And what I would respond to that question with is the sense of, yes, but vulnerability invites further vulnerability, and that's what I'm seeking, I think, to connect with within my own, between my own writing and the reader, that sense of shared vulnerability, that sense of reciprocity between the reader and the writer is really important to me. And at a human level, that sense of shared vulnerability of trust and communication is very important to me as well. So I feel like it's that sense of vulnerability and if we want to call it exposure, you know, and exposing ourselves, which makes us sound like flashers, I always think, you know, and just no to that idea. I think that that sense of sharing vulnerabilities and creating these spaces of sharing those kind of feelings is the basis of really interesting and challenging literature. And literature that readers can engage with and can feel themselves within. And I think that that's a gift.
Darren, you're a gift. Thank you so much for talking to me today.